for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the face of public pressure, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi is apparently backing away from an attempt to dramatically expand his power. Here to talk about Egypt's fragile democracy and its new role on the world stage, Robin Wright of the U.S. Institute of Peace and Woodrow Wilson International Center, Samer Shahata of Georgetown University, and Hisham Melham of Al Arabiya News Channel. Joining us from a studio in Boston is Nicholas Burns of Harvard University. We do welcome your participation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, joining us from Cairo is Nancy Youssef. She's Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Good morning, Nancy. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
The AP is reporting that there are thousands in Tahrir Square. What are you seeing?
That's exactly right. It's extraordinary. The square is already filled, and there are still three groups of marchers headed towards the square, and they haven't even started moving towards downtown yet. And so it's clear that the numbers are going to be massive. And what will be interesting is what kinds of crowds come out today. How much are they representative of the Egyptian population? Are they liberals and secularists and Christians and Morsi's traditional opposition group, or do they really represent the Egyptian population? I think that'll be the best sense in terms of whether what happens today will force Morsi to rescind his decree, or whether he'll be able to wait this controversy out.
Nancy, tell me what kind of flags they're carrying. Do you perceive that there are more in favor of Morsi or many protesting against?
You know, to judge the crowds is to get a sense that people are really against this, and not just against the decree, but that there's a feeling that this democratic revolution hasn't really taken shape, that instead Morsi and his former party, the Muslim Brotherhood, have really treated the election as an opportunity to go for a power grab and in a way keep a lot of the institutions in place this time rather than with the flavor of the regime on there, but instead with the Muslim Brotherhood sort of stamp, if you will, on there.
So what about the statement that Morsi made yesterday, sort of backing away from an authoritative, all-encompassing power grab?
Well, what's interesting is that his spokesman, Yasser Ali, appeared on television, said that they had reached an agreement with the judiciary, and then this morning the news was that from the judiciary that, in fact, there was no agreement. What's interesting in the statement is that he suggests that there's an agreement, but that he maintains control over sovereign matters. But what constitutes a sovereign matter? Presumably, everything the president does is a sovereign matter. So it's hard to see what he had really given up in this process. But Yasser Ali, the spokesman, came out and couched it as a compromise. And I think there was an attempt by the Morsi administration to suggest that he had really backed down. But the word from the judiciary today was that, in fact, there was no agreement, and that they still are maintaining their strike against the administration, and that they will not go to work until there are more changes to the 7-point decree.
Considering the numbers of people in the street, what do you expect to happen now?
Well, it'll be interesting. Essentially, there'll be one of three major paths that I think will come out of this. Either he'll rescind the order at great political cost to him because he's had to take back things like this in the past, or he will come up with a way to buy time and be able to hold on to this major power grab, if you will, or he will come up with some way to suggest that he has in fact reached a consensus, one that that the judiciary embraces. But today will be a decisive day for that, because it will really determine whether he can wait this out or whether this will be a persistent problem until he makes some kind of changes, if not rescind the decree altogether.
Nancy Youssef, she's Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Thanks for joining us, Nancy. Stay safe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And turning to you, Robin Wright, what do you make of all this?
Well, this was a horrendous mistake by an inexperienced politician. Remember, just 8 months ago, he was an unknown engineering professor who emerged very quickly as the Arab world's arguably most powerful leader. But let's look at the context of these actions. The judiciary had disbanded a democratically elected parliament. And there was a widespread belief that the judiciary was about to disband or dissolve the Constituent Assembly that was writing the Constitution. And this would have meant going back basically to square one and electing a new parliament, and then from that body forming a Constituent Assembly to then spend another year writing a constitution. And Egypt has an extraordinary array of very practical daily problems, everything from vast unemployment and economic problems to picking up garbage. And there was a fear that also the forces of the ancien regime, the old order, whether it was in the military or in the media or in the judiciary, might be trying to use extrajudicial means or whatever leverage they had to take back power from the Muslim Brotherhood. And we see this these protests reflect the deep polarization within Egypt, but really across the region, between the Islamist forces and secular forces, between the forces of today's politics and yesterday's politics. And this is not likely to end anytime soon.
Sam Shahata, not likely to end anytime soon.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it depends on how many people show up in Tahrir today. The protests are scheduled for 5 o'clock. And as the reporter said, there are people still getting to Tahrir. So if the protests are massive today, which I think they will be,
thousands,
there will be hundreds
there.
Of thousands,
yeah.
Hundreds of thousands all by right. The end of the day. And if they manage to sustain that level of protest tomorrow and the next day, then I think Morsi might be forced to compromise even more. However, the Brotherhood was supposed to, and supporters of Morsi were supposed to, also protest today. They canceled those protests because they didn't want clashes to occur between the different sides. And they're likely to stage demonstrations on Friday as well. So we'll have to see. I mean, Robin is right. I mean, there is a tremendous polarization in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world between, I wouldn't say, the forces of yesterday and the forces of tomorrow, but Islamists and supposed liberals and secular forces. And when it really comes down to it, the central issue with regard to these constitutional relations is the Constituent Assembly and the Constitution. That's really the most important point here. And there is a major conflict going on about the writing of the Constitution, where a third of the elected representatives, mostly secular individuals, liberal individuals, representatives of the Coptic Church, and so on, have withdrawn in protest because the Constitution is not being written as a consensus document to ensure personal freedoms and the rights of minorities and the rights of women. And it's being really framed as a framework by the Islamist majority who dominate the Constituent Assembly.
But Hisham Elam, last week it looked as though Morsi was in a good place, certainly vis-a-vis the U.S. And then after that agreement to support a truce between the Palestinians and the Israelis, then he declared himself virtually in charge of everything. Why did he take that step? Was it, as Robin says, the act of an inexperienced politician or something else?
It is something else, and it's more complex. The timing is related to the Gaza ceasefire, but this decision must have been under preparation for a long time. obviously. This is, it's true that the Muslim Brotherhood is not as disciplined and as hierarchical as the Nazi Party or the Communist Party under Stalin. But they have a vision, and they have a plan, and they have a history of 80 years of struggle, mostly underground. These people know what they want, and Morsi and company are true believers, and they would like to steer Egypt, the future of Egypt, into a more of an Islamist state.
You're not truly comparing the Muslim Brotherhood to the Nazi Party.
No, 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 no. I'm talking about ideologies that are encompassing. You know, I think what you have here is a leader who gave himself authorities that have never been enjoyed by his four military predecessors or by any monarch. In fact, by any leader in the modern history of Egypt. And I think this is deliberate. And if you look at every decision he made since he was elected, it is toward consolidating more and more power into his hand and giving power to the Islamist and to his party. This is not the action of, this is a very deliberate action by a man who represents a political party, very well organized in Egypt, and he wants to, you know, as I said, turn Egypt into that direction. One could argue that he was concerned about some of the holdovers from the ancien regime, especially in the judiciary. There is an argument to be made there. But it doesn't mean that the Constituent Assembly could not have been changed without resorting to these draconian measures.
Hisham Elami, he is Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. When we come back, you'll hear from Nick Burns, Professor of Diplomacy, International Politics at Harvard University. Welcome back. We're talking about Egypt, what's happening there in terms of power grabbing or power holding or power shifting. Here with me in the studio, Robin Wright. She's the author of Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Samer Shahata, he's Assistant Professor of Arab Politics at Georgetown University, and Hisham Mellem, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. And joining us now from Harvard University in Boston, where he's Professor of Diplomacy and International Politics, Nicholas Burns. Nick Burns, I'd like your impression and your reaction to what is happening in Egypt.
Well, Diane, I certainly agree with many of the comments made so far. This is a power struggle underway between the Islamist parties, Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, the liberal secularist parties on the other. It's a power struggle between President Morsi and the Mubarak-appointed judges. And for the United States, this presents a real challenge. You saw that the Obama administration reacted very carefully, very quietly to these events over the weekend because since the start of the Egyptian Revolution, President Obama has been juggling, I think quite well, with competing American interests. On the one hand, of course, we support democracy taking root, if it can, in Egypt and nurturing that, because that will have, we hope, a beneficial impact in many Arab countries. But we also want to preserve our influence. And so they're trying to, I think, work behind the scenes, not be too critical and directly critical of President Morsi in public, because we need a strong partner in Egypt. We need Egypt to help us preserve the Camp David Accords, the peace between Israel and Egypt negotiated by Jimmy Carter in 1979. We need Egypt now, and we saw this last week, Diane, as a conduit to Hamas to keep that border quiet, Gaza-Israeli border. We certainly will need Egypt as a strong voice countering Iran as the Iran nuclear problem goes forward, and we need them on counterterrorism. So the United States is being very practical here, wanting to support democracy, of course, but wanting to preserve our influence at the same time.
So why do you believe Morsi took the steps that he did? What did he hope to achieve? And do the Egyptian people believe he'll give back those powers if he achieves what he wants to achieve?
Well, I do agree with Robin that this was a colossal political misjudgment by President Morsi. He had, of course, the support of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were going to have a competing demonstration today, which has been called off. I think he felt that his opposition was divided, as it has been divided for most of the last year and a half. But we've seen that many of these disputatious politicians of a liberal sort have united over this issue, and they really forced him to back down. So on this issue, I think he's going to have to tread very carefully. A lot will depend on whether this protest movement can be sustained in the streets of Cairo and Alexandria. And that's an open question, because we've seen these protests fizzle out in the past. I think he'll wait. He'll wait to see if he needs to make any further moves.
Sam.
Well, that's correct. And he's tried to yesterday, with regard to his meeting with the Supreme Judicial Council and the statement, to back down quite a bit and to say that not only are these powers limited in time, but that his edicts that are not subject to judicial oversight only relate to matters of national sovereignty. Of course, that's not clarified what that means. Now, again, the key motivating factor for Morsi to undertake this measure was the fear, the real fear, that the Supreme Judicial, the Constitutional Court, would nullify the Constituent Assembly, and then everything would have to start from scratch all over again. I mean, the key point here is that Egypt's so-called transition to democracy has been a complete mess. Before it was messy, now it's a mess. And there is no consensus about the process or the sequence of moving forward, whether it's constitution first, elections first, how do you write a constitution, who gets to write it, what kind of a document is it going to be. And there is a struggle, as has been discussed by everyone here, between Islamists and non-Islamist forces about the constitution, about what the Egypt of the future is going to be, particularly with regard to the relationship between religion and state.
Robin.
We all know about the fog of war. This is the fog of transition. And it is this moment where Morsi, I think, was talking about a very limited time frame, maybe 4 months. The Constitution is due by February. And that then it goes, then Egypt can move on. It can have new elections. All of these countries, when they had their elections for new parliaments, were just for a year or so while new constitutions were written. And then people go to the polls again. And that's the process that I think Morsi was trying to energize and make sure stayed on schedule. Because there is also another reality. People are increasingly disillusioned with the new leaders. And this preceded this particular moment or this particular action. They're all very frustrated that jobs haven't been created, resources haven't been redistributed, and they want to get on with life. Remember, the uprisings began because a young fruit vendor wanted a job, not because he wanted to vote for a liberal democratic party. That's what preoccupies people throughout the Arab world.
Hisham, Samer Shahata talked about religion and state. And the question is whether one is going to dominate or whether there can be a satisfactory blending of the two.
We've been having intellectual and political debates in the Arab world since the mid-18th century about the relationship between religion and state, about the relationship between the Arab world and the West, about the relationship between the state and the citizen, about issues of women's rights and, you know, and empowerment and rights of minorities. We've been discussing this. We've been there, and we've done that. Now, these are real issues, and we continue to deal with them, obviously. The problem with Morsi's edict, one of the problems, is the issue of temporarily. You know, this is a temporary measure. I remind you that Arab leaders in the last few decades have imposed, quote-unquote, temporary emergency laws that have been temporary for decades. What is temporary today in the Middle East is permanent tomorrow. And I do not trust people like Morsi, who are driven by certain ideological impulses and tendencies. They have an ideology. I didn't compare them with the Nazis and the communists, but they have an overall, overarching ideology. They want Egypt to be an Islamist state. There is a debate here, and we know that there is polarization in Egypt, but also the secularists and the Democrats and the progressives and the non-Islamists, let's put it this way, are terribly afraid, and they should be, because of the tenor of the debate that is taking place. There are powerful voices in Egypt that are calling for a religious state, not a civil state. And the debate is here. And these guys have been driven out of the Constituent Assembly that is supposed to write the new constitution. So they are afraid that the Islamists, not only the Brotherhood, but the Salafis, are trying to determine the future of Egypt and set it, as you know, in the course of an Islamist state. And they have very good reason to be afraid.
Nick Burns.
Well, I certainly agree with much of what Hisham has said, but I would say one thing. We saw a very pragmatic side of Morsi last week when he restrained Hamas, when he worked through Hillary Clinton very well with the Israeli government, when he saw the need to bring that terrible barrage of artillery on both sides where civilians suffered to an end. And sometimes people surprise us, and I never agreed with some of our own commentators here in the States who say we can't work with a Muslim Brotherhood. I think President Obama and Secretary Clinton have shown they can work with him on a pragmatic basis. And I think the Obama administration has been smart to be a little bit standoffish here and not appear to be trying to direct events in Egypt. We can't. We can't control these forces. We can have some influence in the margins. And I think a little bit of distance from us publicly is probably the right perspective right now.
But Nick, how will what's happening in Egypt have an impact or not on what's happening in Israel?
Well, the Israelis, if you look at, Diane, the events of the last now nearly 2 years, the Israelis have had a very serious setback for all their strategic interests. Their northern border with Syria and the Golan has been destabilized. They're very worried about potential instability in Jordan to their east. And now they have a much more dangerous relationship with an emboldened Hamas. So they are counting on developing, maintaining some type of effective, pragmatic, behind-the-scenes relationship with Egypt to control some of these forces. I think Egypt has become Egypt's been revived as the great power of the Arab world, and now is the deal maker of the Arab world. So Morsi may have trouble at home this week, but he is a considerable figure internationally.
Robin.
Yes, I think actually that Morsi has proven to be as powerful as any Egyptian leader in the past, or is certainly as pivotal in terms of defining what happens next. Remember, he did not declare a jihad. He did not break off relations with Israel. And he moved rather expeditiously to make sure that Hamas, which is a wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, which emerged out of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, actually engaged in a ceasefire with Israel. And there are, as unlikely as it may seem, there are those within the Muslim Brotherhood who say they will be more effective in negotiating a peace deal long-term with Israel than Hosni Mubarak had. Mubarak was invested in keeping instability because this is the way he got both foreign aid and power in terms of his standing, whether it was in the international community or in the Arab world, whereas the Muslim Brotherhood still has to prove its bona fides. Now, it's still not going to be easy. But there is a sense, because of these transitions across the Arab world, that for the first time, most of them are are less interested in energizing or supporting a conflict because they have so many pressures at home. They have to deliver, and that's where their focus is. And there is a sense that let's move on. Let's get beyond this.
I think Morsi's so-called pragmatism should not blind us to the history and the practices of the Muslim Brotherhood. We are talking about a movement that's been there for 80 years. They have compromised, quote-unquote, with a lot of Egyptian rulers. They play the game. They know if the wind is too strong, they lean with it. They don't stand up against it because it will break them. They are shrewd in that sense, and they are pragmatic in that sense. Nobody expected the Muslim Brotherhood to declare jihad on Israel. Egypt today is a country on the verge of economic bankruptcy. Egypt today, as we all of us agree here, is a society that is deeply polarized. Egypt today is a weak reed still, notwithstanding the great achievement of the ceasefire. When he did the ceasefire, his calculus was raison d'etat. Egypt has the same strategic interests, whether it is ruled by a pharaoh or a turbaned man or a Mubarak or a bearded pharaoh like Morsi. He was playing by Egyptian rule and Egyptian interest. It is in his own interest to do that. He is still consolidating power. While consolidating power, you cannot challenge a strong state like Israel.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones. We have a number of callers, 800-433-8850. First to Hamlin, New York. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead, sir.
Well, I like hearing the conversation you're having. I'll just confess I'm not an expert, but, I mean, I understand from reading The Nation, The Progressive, over the years of Mubarak's rule, that, I mean, he got a lot of funds from the U.S. and stuff and propped him up and anything. But really, did anything happen to help change the Palestinian situation? I don't really think so, because he still wanted that money. I would hope that Morsi is going to help change that kind of stalemate that's been happening, the settlements that have been happening and stuff like that, and create something where the Palestinians are finally able to have, you know, a better relationship with the Israelis and stuff and work things out. I mean, it's just sad to see, you know, all this trouble that's been going on. I like the fact that it was a peaceful, I mean, a pretty much a nonviolent uprising in Israel that tore down Mubarak. So.
All right, Samer.
Well, I think the caller has a point. I mean, the idea is, of course, that if you have democratic states in the Arab world, democratic leaders in the Arab world that are accountable to their populations, and those populations are sympathetic with the suffering of the Palestinian people and their dispossession and so on, then those governments are going to more forcefully press on Israel to negotiate a settlement that is just for the Palestinians. Mr. Mubarak, of course, was more interested in staying in power and suppressing Islamist challengers and also suppressing Islamists in the West Bank and in Gaza than he was in supporting Palestinian rights. So the idea is, of course, that democratic governments in Egypt, Turkey, Tunisia, and elsewhere will somehow provide more symmetry in terms of balance of power, and that will, in the end, help Palestinians. We saw, for example, the first time a Tunisian government delegation enter Gaza to support the Palestinians. We saw Arab ministers. We saw the Egyptian prime minister go to Gaza during the fighting and so on. And that hopefully will provide some balance in this incredibly asymmetrical conflict.
All right, to Miami, Florida. Hi there, Marilyn.
Hi, Diane. I just want to say that I absolutely love your show.
Thank
and I've
you.
Been trying all the time to speak with you. But I, you know, my student at FIU was acquiring a certificate in Middle Eastern Studies. I have a question, which I, when this whole Arab Spring came about and the incident with Tunisia and Egypt, you know, if truly getting rid of Hosni Mubarak was truly, you know, to the advantage of the Egyptian state, because now, when, like one of your panels said, basically there, it was kind of messy before, but now it's just a mess.
All right, Nick Burns.
Well, I would say, Diane, in answer to Marilyn's question, that I don't think President Obama had a choice in early February of 2011. about disavowing President Mubarak, because Mubarak had lost his credibility in Egypt. He'd lost control of the streets. He'd lost control of his own security apparatus and government. So I think the president, our president, had to make this very important decision to throw his support behind those very idealistic young people in Tahrir Square. But I would say this. The 30 years where the United States dealt with Mubarak was not a total loss to the United States. His fatal flaw, of course, was the authoritarian nature of his government. But Mubarak did secure the peace agreement, Camp David Accords, with Israel. That gave us 3 decades of stability between those two states. And he was a very important partner of the United States in confronting the al-Qaedas of the world. So it wasn't, I think the United States had some of its interests met in those years, but we're in a better position now to try to work with these young, untested governments to see if we can help them on the margins to secure a democratic future. And I think the United States is well positioned to do that.
Nicholas Burns, professor at Harvard University. We'll take a short break here. Marilyn, thank you for your call. We'll take more when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating National Adoption Month and promoting lifelong families for all children at aecf.org. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Futurist Ray Kurzweil explores the latest advances in artificial intelligence and inner workings of the human brain, smart machines, and prospects for immortality. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back as we talk about the ongoing struggle in Egypt, especially after President Morsi proclaimed new powers to himself. Samer Shahata, there is a new constitution that must be written. What is the latest on that process?
Well, the process is ongoing, and the Constitutional Drafting Committee was supposed to come up with a finalized draft constitution this month and then put it to a referendum. But the problem has been that there is intense factionalism and disagreement, largely between Islamists, different types of Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the more extreme Salafis, and liberal and secular elements who don't feel that the Constitution is a progressive document, that the Constitution guarantees freedoms, that the Constitution is based on the principle of equality of all citizens, regardless of gender, and so on, and protection of other minorities. And so there have been, as was mentioned previously, Several dozen people who have withdrawn in protest from the Constituent Assembly, liberals and secular forces. Amr Moussa, former Secretary General of the Arab League, Ayman Nour, once an opposition figure to Mr. Mubarak, representatives of the Coptic Church, other well-known Egyptian journalists who are liberals and so on. And there are some major concerns about the legitimacy of this document. And unfortunately, it is likely, if the current makeup of the Constituent Assembly is to continue, that we're going to get a document that really falls far short of what many of us hoped would be a post-Mubarak Egypt.
And Robin, is that in part the reason Morsi declared these authoritative new powers?
Yes, and the idea, as I said earlier, was to have this be a short-term process to kind of nudge everybody onward. A couple of things. First of all, one of the problems is who should write the Constitution? And that's really what you get down to. And the fact is, people went to the polls in Egypt and they elected a parliament that was dominated by Islamists. Two different parties got 70%. They took 60% of the seats in the Constituent Assembly. And now there was a lot of, oh, wait a minute, you know, they shouldn't have the right to dominate the Constitution writing process. But the core issue was reflected in a statement from the Justice Minister yesterday, who said the tragedy is that Egyptians in a new democracy don't know how to talk to each other. And that's one of the problems you find across the Arab world. It's true in Libya and Tunisia, all the countries undergoing transitions. And the big thing is that constitutions are far more difficult and far more important in determining the new order than the first democratic elections. We tend to think who wins elections and then what happens, but it happened during the Iranian Revolution. It was the moment that the clerics came back and said that the secular parties are killing each other, literally. And there were 6,400 amendments offered for that constitution. And so the Ayatollah Khomeini came back and said, we have to oversee this process. And that's unfortunately where it got stuck. Now, there are three issues that will divide as they look to the future. One is the role of Islam in the state. And that's why the Muslim Brotherhood and the rival secular groups are duking it out in a way, at least politically, because each has a different vision of the future. The second is women's rights and minority rights, because for the first time, women are one of the two engines of change across the Middle East. And the third is the issue of blasphemy. And we saw how sensitive issues of criticizing either Islam or the Prophet Muhammad can be in the tragic attack on the American consulate or mission in Benghazi, which cost the life of Chris Stevens, and then the embassy in Tunisia.
Would the new constitution include any kind of term limits?
Well, that's one of the things that is being discussed. There are a lot of things on the table. Welcome to democracy. It's diversity. And people have different opinions. And the interesting thing is that after this disillusionment had led to a lethargy in Egypt, you now see people on the streets again. This is democracy. Mm. People are getting out. People are being hurt. Unfortunately, three people have been killed now. But it's really interesting to see that we've only seen phase one of the uprisings of the revolution. There are other phases to go.
Sam.
Yes, the answer to your question is the term limit for the president has been set for 2 terms, and the term has been shortened from 6 years to 4 years. Remember, Mr. Mubarak was president for 29-plus years, and there were no term limits. Another good thing, of course, is that the ability or restrictions on nominating oneself for the presidency have been greatly reduced, making real competition possible. The problem, however, as Robin said, is this, again, and I would put the question of women and minorities under the rubric of religion and state, because if you have a constitution that says that the state will safeguard and protect ethics and public morals, what does that mean? If you have a constitution that says, as Article 68 now says, that there will be equality between men and women as long as it doesn't contravene the Sharia, what does that mean?
That's the point.
And if you have then further explication of what the Sharia means in a way that is different than what I think the Sharia means, then you have a real problem here. So the Constitution, again, is at the heart of this matter. Why Morsi made the Constitutional Declaration was because he knew the Supreme Constitutional Court, all holdovers from the Mubarak regime, and the judiciary is infested, unfortunately, with Mubarak, was going to nullify the Constituent Assembly.
Nick Burns.
Well, I'm looking for the silver lining. And the silver lining is we're seeing real politics emerge in Egypt for the first time in a very long time, where public opinion matters. This is positive. But it's also turbulent, messy, somewhat dysfunctional. Looks a lot sometimes like our own system.
Indeed an optimist, I must say.
Trying to appreciate the complexity of this situation, that, you know, if you look at us, we emerged from Yorktown. It took us well over a decade to get through the Articles of Confederation to George Washington as our first president. We need to be patient. This is going to be a roller coaster of political emotion and infighting. We just need to stay engaged, appreciate what's happening, and support the democratic process.
I wish we had in Egypt the founding brothers that we had in this country. Look, if you look at the constitutions of a number of Arab states, they are nice documents. Even now, even in the so-called autocratic repressive regimes, they are nice, but they were never taken seriously. What makes these the process of writing constitutions in Egypt and in Tunisia and other places is that the first time you have real powers representing real people trying to come up with a new draft and a new constitution that works. And that's why, if we're talking about diversity, there are people who believe in Egypt, the secularists and the nationalists and the non-Islamists, let's say, who are saying essentially that if we don't challenge the Islamists, they will impose their own vision on us, and then we will end up in an Islamist state. Unless the Constitution talks about equality among genders and, you know, equality among the rights of citizens, okay, without giving us this opaque, ambiguous reference to Sharia, because then we are, you know, we will be susceptible to all sorts of interpretations, then we are going to have a problem. And I think this is a real fight. Okay, yes, they had the majority, but it doesn't mean that the majority is going to impose or should be allowed to impose its vision on everybody in society. Majoritarianism is not democracy. And this is a primitive view in the Muslim world that I have the majority, I can do whatever I want, and I am above the law. This is a very serious thing.
I agree with some of what Hisham said, but not all of what Hisham said. Clearly, citizenship and absolute equality between all citizens needs to be mandated. However, the idea of the Sharia being in the Constitution, as it was in Article 2, as it is in many states, is largely, or should be largely, a symbolic aspect of politics. That is that the majority of Egyptians are Muslim. And in fact, no one, not even the Coptic Church, not even secular figures and liberals or Mohammed Brady, objects to that. What we do object to is saying something like the Sharia means this, that women aren't equal to men, or that the state needs to protect the ethics and the public morals of people based on this tradition of Sharia. So it's not that the Sharia needs to be excluded from the Constitution. It's that the Constitution, as you said, should not be a document that puts in place the vision of the majority. But the most important part of all constitutions are to protect freedoms, to protect rights, and especially to protect the rights of minorities.
Let me understand. Under President Mubarak, how did women fare? Robin.
Well, there were reforms that dealt with sensitive issues such as female genital mutilation. This was legally banned, even though it continued as a practice. There were women who were brought into the political system, but as a quota. So there were initiatives, but the interesting thing is that women were as much a part of this revolution as men were, and they were on the front lines often. And I actually share Nick's underlying optimism about the long term. The short term, it's going to be awful. The next decade is going to be more turbulent than the last one. But the fact is they've begun a process. And when you look at how long, from everyone's crazy about the movie Lincoln, and it took a century for us to go from a civil war to enacting the Voting Rights Act.
But
this takes time. You know, things don't sort themselves out overnight, and particularly in a society that's lived under, for 5,000 years, autocratic rule in different forms.
At the same time, having seen Lincoln, I recognize that news did not travel as quickly back then as it does now. And seeing people gathering in the streets, seeing people denied rights, that news travels very quickly, Samer.
Well, that's correct. I mean, and just to be, you know, to state something explicitly, I mean, I have no, of course, fondness or nostalgia for the Mubarak era, and I think it would be absurd to think somehow that, you know, this is worse than what it is. And I am optimistic also in the medium and long term for Egypt. But the transition to democracy is not easy. And unfortunately, the contentious, divisive politics are obstacles to forward progress, to some kind of stability, to addressing the questions that matter the most to 99% of Egyptians, which are jobs, which are security in the streets, which are economic development, which are schools that actually function, and hospitals and healthcare institutions that actually are capable of providing healthcare. And unfortunately, these political battles, which are occupying, of course, the attention of the elite political class, are getting in the way of addressing those major foundational issues that will really determine whether Egypt progresses or not in the future.
All right. I want to take a call from San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Lily.
Good morning, Diane. I'm calling. You had a little exchange. Hisham said he's not going to compare the Muslim Brotherhood to Nazis. I sort of want to remind you of Iranian Revolution. The conversation came up a couple of times, and I compare them. I went through the Iranian Revolution, and I remember distinctly how Robin Wright tried to excuse and make excuses and explain away, and I see the same thing happening little by little going through, and I think the same dogmatic. I agree totally with what Hisham said. I can see it, just how it's going through and how they're going to use, Islamic. We in Iran, we had a better constitution before the revolution, and of course it was kind of ignored. But then, you know, they promised such a glorious thing and Islamic blah blah blah, and you know they stepped all over those. You know, and they made a ridiculous constitution that they can use. Even if they ignore that, I'm not that articulate. I'm sorry.
I think you've been very articulate, Lily. Thank you for your call. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder and the experience of some who've lived through these revolutions. Robin.
There's no question that Iran's democratic revolution in 1979 was hijacked by the clerics. The constitution is actually based on French and Belgian law. It is a republican constitution. And one of the most important things that's happening in the Arab world is the fact that Islamist parties that are dominating the political new political horizon are actually turning to right republican constitutions as well. They're not using Saudi Arabia as a model where Sharia is the basis of law. I agree. The clerics have failed the Iranian people in colossal ways, and that's one of the tragedies. But it was also the division among the political parties in Iran that provided the context or the opportunity for the clerics to move in and seize power.
Samer.
Well, the problem, unfortunately, are these comparisons are inappropriate. I mean, the idea that somehow the Muslim Brotherhood is similar to the Nazi Party in Germany, or that the Egyptian Revolution in 2011 is similar to the 1979 Iranian Revolution, which was an incredibly violent revolution, led to a civil war with immediately dozens, if not hundreds, of public executions and summary justice, is completely inappropriate. Now, that doesn't mean that this revolution is rosy and wonderful and we all can hold hands and so on, but the comparisons do more damage to our understanding than elucidate what is really going on.
Just quickly, when I made the comparison, I was just talking about the structure and the discipline. I was not talking about ideologies or whatever. And these are different historical epochs, and this should go without, you know, saying. Obviously, everybody knows that I have a jaundiced view of the Islamists. I don't trust what they say. I do not believe that in their outlook, in this current outlook, including the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think the Salafis are beyond pale as far as I'm concerned, because they live in a different century, in a different parallel universe. as long as they don't undergo a serious reform about how they see women in particular, how they see minorities in particular. I'm talking about all of the Islamist movement, whether we're talking about Ennahda in Tunisia or the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafis in Egypt and other places. Unless they have that kind of serious reform, they have a problem. Islamist regimes and Islamist political parties have a serious problem with women. They don't see them as equal, and they have a serious problem with non-Muslim minorities. And unless we deal with this issue squarely and honestly and bluntly, we should not trust their intentions.
And that is the last word. Hisham Melon, Samer Shahata, Robin Wright, Nicholas Burns, thank you all so much. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Urev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and